thank you, Rich, and thank you to everybody for being here. It's heartening to see you all. Some of you I haven't seen your faces in months, so great to see you here in this little room that we've gathered in to discuss these important topics. I want to just start by reminding you, if we could go to the next slide, please. I want to just start by reminding you of Safe Passage's mission. You're all familiar, but our vision is that no child should face immigration court alone. All of our clients are young people who could not otherwise afford to pay for an attorney to help defend themselves against deportation. Why do they need attorneys to help defend themselves against deportation? Well, immigration court is civil, it's not criminal, even though there are really serious liberty interests at stake, even though immigration proceedings are often life or death issues, no one is appointed free legal counsel. So either you pay for an attorney, you go up before a judge and a trained prosecutor alone, or you try to find someone to provide pro bono legal services. So that's where Safe Passage comes in. That's where our amazing staff and our army of over 500 pro bono attorneys comes in. And that's where all of you come in, because we wouldn't be able to do all of this without your support. Okay, so I'll get started just by doing a brief overview. If we could go to the next slide. Thank you. So this next slide, as we navigate there, it is a kind of a summary of what's happening in Central America right now. Most of Safe Passage's clients are young people from the Northern Triangle of Central America. So that is Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Of course, we have clients from all over the world. I personally have represented clients at Safe Passage from Bangladesh, from Mali, from Ecuador. But in general, our clients tend to come from the Northern Triangle of Central America for a variety of reasons, historical, you know, the situation on the ground. But the fact of the matter is that the situation in those three countries is quite dire. There are extreme dangers facing young people in particular, and it causes them to flee in really record numbers. So the next slide is good, I think. So young people have fled in record numbers, and they arrive at the US-Mexico border, not just with the goal of leaving their home country, but really with the goal of, in many cases, reuniting with family members who are already here in the United States. And because our clients are children, that makes perfect sense, right? They don't just wanna flee the danger that they were experiencing, they want to you know, come back to their family's arms for protection. So young people leave their home country, they come to the US-Mexico border, and of course what they face there is more extreme hardship. Especially over the last 3 years, we have seen a number of attempts to really halt all forms of immigration at the border, both what we would call an entry without inspection, so crossing the border with the goal of either not being detected or just because they don't know where else to cross. Migrants cross the border there. We've seen attempts to stop those crossings. We've also seen attempts to even halt border crossings at so-called ports of entry, ports, you know, gateways that are specifically designed for the process of people claiming asylum. We have seen the current administration attempt to shut that down as well. And that is just at the border. Of course, Lenny Benson, professor of immigration law, will tell you that in reality, because of the way our immigration law is constructed, the border really extends throughout the country. So unless someone has a visa to cross the border, even if they make their way into the United States, they're still essentially knocking on the door, asking for what's called admission to the United States. And here's just a sampling of some headlines that show the ways in which that those applications have been halted or otherwise attempts to prevent people from being admitted as lawful permanent residents to the United States. We can go to the next slide. So this is, just to put things in context, a slide that demonstrates just how many unaccompanied children have arrived at the US-Mexico border over the last approximately 10 years. We use the phrase unaccompanied alien children because that is the phrase, that's the technical legal term in our immigration law, UAC or unaccompanied alien child. As an immigration advocate, find that term very dehumanizing, but it is the term that we see in technical legal documents. So I tend to call them unaccompanied child, an unaccompanied kid. But these are the numbers you can see really over the, and we've included Mexico here because historically Mexico had the largest number of unaccompanied minors arriving at the United States. That makes sense. It's a contiguous country. It borders our own. But you can see really since 2014 and then on through 2019, and the numbers have been consistent through had been on track to be consistent through 2020. El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are sending, are seeing really an increased number of young people needing to seek solace here in the United States. So with that, I'm gonna hand it off to my colleague Desiree, who's gonna tell you a little bit more about what an asylee actually is.
So we talk a lot about asylum, and sometimes asylum is linked to political asylum. But the reality of our asylum laws is that it is not just for political situations. Asylum versus refugee is something that I just want to clarify really quickly. An asylee is someone who's outside of their home country and in the United States or knocking at our door the way that Alex was explaining at our border. So it can be someone within the United States already or someone that is at the border. Refugee is someone that is outside of their country of origin and is applying in another country, in another place, for asylee or refugee status. So while the definition is very similar, we're talking about where that person is and the process that they go through applying. And we're just going to focus on asylees because these are the clients that we see. So they have to, this is the definition of an asylee, and they have to meet the definition of an asylee in order to get granted asylum. So the first thing is that they need to show that they've suffered past persecution, or they have a fear that if they're returned to their home country, that they will suffer future persecution. They have to show that the persecution that they suffered was done by the government or a private individual or group that the government is unable and unwilling to control. And if you see a trend here of just like a mouthful of words, this is really the definition. And each one of these definitions has been litigated through many years of our asylum law. But the, you know, something that we really need to focus on is that we're not just talking about political asylum. We're talking about that you can get granted asylee status if you have a particular motive, if there's a motive, a connection between the persecution that the person suffered and the motive. So what is the motivation? The motivation is that it's due to a person's race or religion or nationality or a political opinion. And it's also due to their membership in a particular social group. And again, those five different motives are get kind of complicated and dicey depending on which one there are, but some of them are very self-explanatory. And then the person has to show that returning to their home country is not reasonable because they cannot just relocate to a different area to stop that persecution. They have to show that they're not subject to any bars of admission and that they warrant a favorable exercise of discretion. And one of the things that you might notice is that this doesn't say specifically children. This doesn't say women or people that have been subjected to domestic violence or abuse. So it is our job to look at the definition and look at the children that we see in front of us and say, where does this child fit in within the definition of an asylee? And where can we start advocating for them so that they get the protection that they are seeking within the United States? So I can go on for a really long time about just this definition, but we're gonna move on and go to the next slide. So a question that we get a lot and we try to explain to people is why don't they just do it legally? And it's explaining they are doing it legally. The children that are coming to our border, that is the only way that they can actually apply for asylum because there's no refugee processing outside of the United States in America. So they can't just go to another country within the Americas and apply to go there or within their own country. There was a program that was called the Central Americans Minors Program that was created under the Obama administration to try to have the children that met certain requirements come to the country safely. That program was eliminated very quickly within 2017. There's also no other way for them to apply for other reasons. So there's a form of relief that we deal with, which is called special immigrant juvenile status. They cannot apply for that outside of the country. They need to be within the country to apply for it. So avenues of relief, that is, asylum truly is the only one that they can pursue that is based on humanitarian grounds. Family-based grounds, which is something that we see that we see often, which is I am an immigrant and I'm applying for my family to come and join me within the United States. That is very restrictive, and the children may not have the adequate family members that qualify to file for them. One of the biggest communities that we have in New York are people that are from Central America that were granted status that is called temporary protected status. And that is a status that allows people to remain in the United States, to work legally, to have a completely legal life within the United States. But it doesn't allow for them to apply for their family members to come and join them within the United States. So even if you have a parent that is really willing and able to help you and to have you come to the United States legally, they cannot apply for you. So these are one of the reasons why they can't just come to the country in a safer way. They have to put their lives at risk and come to our border to ask for asylum. Alex?
Thank you, Desiree. So we have seen, as I'm sure you've all seen in the news, there have been many, many, many proposed changes and actual changes to the ways in which asylum is adjudicated in the United States. Now, as Desiree just described, and as you could probably tell from the definition that she carefully read, it was never easy to be granted asylum status in the United States. You have to show that you have suffered persecution or fear future persecution on account of one of those five very particular grounds. You can't have been able to relocate. You can't be subject to certain other bars to asylum. That multi-layered definition makes for an extremely high bar for someone to meet in order to actually get asylum. So, you know, it's never like unaccompanied minors were kind of waltzing in the country, filing their asylum application, and then walking out with their green card, you know, 2 months later. It simply has never been that easy. The standard, the evidentiary standard to prove that you're eligible for asylum is quite high. You know, we could go on, and I'm doing it now, so I'll stop, but we could go on for, you know, hours and hours about every single aspect of that definition and just how much case law and how much, you know, agency guidance and how much policy, how many policy documents have been written to help us interpret who qualifies for asylum and who doesn't. It's really some of the most heavily litigated and complex law in the country. So I say that all because I want to point out that it was never easy to win asylum. But over the past several years, we have seen an even further tightening of asylum eligibility, really to the point where if every adjudicator was following the proposed rules and changes of the current administration, I don't think that anyone, you know, would grant asylum without, you know, really extreme litigation on the side of the person who's applying. And that's kind of what Safe Passage has been doing this entire time. So I'm going to describe a little bit some of the proposed changes, some of which have been enacted, some of which haven't. And then we can kind of move into, you know, how Safe Passage is dealing with all of that. So the first thing I want to discuss are new proposed regulations that were issued in June of 2020. That is really, I would say, the most significant proposed change to asylum law that I've ever seen. I would love, you know, maybe later Lenny can chime in on that, but I've never seen or heard of proposed changes that were that extensive. They were 161 pages. And we only had, you know, because of administrative procedure law, we advocates for immigrants or and other concerned citizens had only 30 days to respond to the administration's proposed changes. Now, some of the changes that I'm not going to go into all of them because again, 161 pages, but some of the most important changes that were proposed were, for example, a rule that would allow an immigration judge or adjudicator to not even hear testimony from an asylum applicant, to just look at their page and then say, you know, you don't qualify. I'm denying your asylum application. It's called pretermitting an asylum claim. And it's really problematic in terms of due process. Because the whole notion is that an asylum applicant should have the opportunity to have their case heard by a trained adjudicator. And if they're not testifying, if they're not presenting their full claim, how can someone really decide just by looking at a piece of paper whether they qualify or not? There was a manner of entry rule proposed, meaning anybody who crossed the border, you know, without a visa and who didn't go through a port of entry, the adjudicator would have the opportunity to deny their claim solely as a matter of discretion. That's obviously concerning because if you're a young person, at least for Safe Passage's clients, if you're a young person, you might not know where a port of entry is on the US-Mexico border. I didn't know where ports of entry were on the US-Mexico border until I started doing this work. But the proposed rule would prohibit anyone who, or would allow a manner of entry crossing without inspection to be the basis for denying an asylum claim. There are the safe third country rule, which would deny asylum to someone if that asylum seeker passed through another country on their way to the United States and didn't ask for asylum. What's interesting about the safe third country rule is that it's currently being litigated, 10 ways from Sunday, and courts have struck it down, and yet it was still written into these new proposed regulations. So the idea is if anybody crosses through, you know, say you're leaving from El Salvador and you need to cross through Guatemala and then Mexico to get to the US to claim asylum, if you didn't apply for asylum in both Guatemala and or Mexico, the US is going to deny your asylum claim. That's extremely problematic. And then finally, we're seeing changes like fee increases. There's going to be supposedly asylum seekers are going to be charged money to file their asylum application. That was never the case before. There are changes related to who's eligible to receive a work permit. Previously, asylum applicants could receive a work permit if their asylum application had been pending for 180 days. Now, many asylum seekers are not going to be eligible for a work permit at all. And then it extends the waiting time for others, which will frankly result in more real life suffering because people are not going to be able to earn a living to pay for food or rent. Am I wrapping up here? Yeah. Okay.
We're getting really good questions. So maybe just talk a little bit about COVID and what's going on now, and then we can sort of open it up. And you'll also, I think, be able to give a lot more color when we get to some of the questions because they're about
definitely. Okay. So the this next slide is Desiree's.
I'll be brief, but one of the biggest changes that we've seen is that the government is violating something that's called the Flores Agreement, the Flores Settlement, which is the rules that govern nationally about how children should be treated that are coming, unaccompanied children should be treated when they're coming to our border. And it's a violation not only of this agreement, but of due process and the way that we've established by law with the TVPRA, the law that that governs asylum seekers that are unaccompanied children. It's just devastating. They're denying the entry of children at the border, so they're not letting them come from Mexico into the United States. The ones that are entering and they're allowing into the United States, they're holding them in secret rooms before expelling them. They're accusing them of being a national security issue, saying that they have COVID, even though they are testing them, making sure that they don't have COVID before they send them back to their home country, which is just, again, an excuse that they're using to not allow the children to come in. And the difference of children being allowed to come in is it's very big. In March of this year, they allowed over 1,000 children in, continuing the trend that we had seen throughout 2020 and 2019. From April to June, they only allowed about 162 children into the country, which is just a clear showing how they are violating the laws that are in place to protect children. Family separation has been renewed, and that could be the topic of a 2-hour discussion, which I'm not gonna get into. But why is this so important that they're denying them access? And when I said earlier about the definition of asylum, this means that they can't apply for asylum. So that is why this is, the children are fleeing actually dangerous circumstances. They qualify for asylum and they can seek asylum within the United States. And next slide. But thankfully, Safe Passage Project continues to try to solve the issue of all the children that were already here in a way that we can say, well, at least we have, there are enough children. It's a good thing and a bad thing, right? It's terrible that children are still facing the immigration process alone, but enough children were allowed into the United States in the last few years that still need our help. So we are continuing to screen children and match them with attorneys, and our cases are moving forward. We've been able to work in virtual courts and have virtual hearings, and also have cases being adjudicated with just the filings that we submit. So our work continues, even though the courts are trying to stop the children from coming in. Alex?
Thanks, Desiree. And so a lot of the work that we're doing on local and national levels in terms of policy and impact litigation, that's all ongoing. So for example, Ms. L. V. Ice is the foundational case related to family separations. Safe Passage Project is on a steering committee of really just a few organizations that serve unaccompanied children specifically, or immigrant kids specifically. Ms. L is an actual woman, and she is the named class member of parents who had been separated from their kids. So So Ms. L. V. Ice is really considers the family separation crisis from the parents' perspective. And the purpose of the steering committee is to integrate child-focused concerns into that litigation. So we've been working very closely with the ACLU, which represents Ms. L and others, so that concerns related specifically to kids are heard. And Desiree mentioned this in the coronavirus slide, but the way family separations are coming up again is that parents are being given a really impossible choice. And again, likely a choice that is violative of the law, but we need to litigate it, where parents are told you can either sit in detention with your kid and at, you know, hugely increased risk of getting COVID, or we can let your kid go and separate you and you'll stay in detention and your kid will be released or moved to a child-friendly facility. So that's really family separation part two, part three. And so we continue to advise and talk with plaintiff's counsel about these issues. Joshua M. V. Barr is a case in federal court that we are still in the process of litigating, but it essentially involves a young person who was, in our opinion, improperly ordered removed. And we're arguing that he can't litigate his case from Honduras. He needs to be present in the United States in order to pursue his asylum and special immigrant juvenile status claims, because if he's removed to Honduras, it is very likely that he, frankly, will die there. And so we are litigating that case in a very novel way using concepts of habeas corpus law and integrating immigration law into what's traditionally a constitutional law context. We have also been giving, writing really lengthy comments to proposed regulations. So we just submitted 20 pages single spaced to the, you know, most recent asylum regulations. And we're conducting continued advocacy with local stakeholders like ICE, the immigration court. And we have some really interesting work that we're doing on legislation in New York State to hopefully result in every child in New York State receiving a free attorney. It's not going to come from the federal level, but states could, like we do in criminal defense work, assign every child with essentially a public defender. And so we are really trying to push that legislation forward.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Desiree. Thank you, Alex.